Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hello, folks, and welcome to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, and a quick shout out to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Thanks also to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway is Central Iowa's premier good food store and brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. If you're looking for quality foods with a community focus, check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Joe has been doing residential commercial land for, 23 years or more. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses like Ritual Cafe. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. I would like to welcome to the program Josh Mandelbaum. He's, are you still with the Environmental Law and Policy Center?
I'm still at the Environmental Law and Policy Center.
And also a third term city council member?
Two terms.
Second.
Up for my third.
Up for your third. Okay, welcome to the program.
Yep.
Water quality has been a huge issue in Des Moines, in Iowa. In fact, it's been such a huge issue, it's made some national news, none of it good. But we have right now a water quality problem with nitrates at levels that exceed even the EPA standard, which again, some people have questions about whether that standard is low enough. And as a result, the nitrate removal system the Des Moines Water Works has is barely able to keep up with the demand. Actually, it's unable to keep up with the demand. So we've just, in the last month or so, people have not been able to water their lawns, and a few other things have been restricted, even though the rivers are full, because the system can't keep up with removing the nitrates and making the water safe. This is not good.
It's not good at all, and it's not a water quantity problem, it's a water quality problem. There is so much pollution flowing through our rivers right now. Our drinking water system can't keep up with it at the current EPA standard. And
who is the culprit?
So we know the bulk of this is coming from agricultural pollution upstream. It's not a surprise. We've dealt with this for years. We have really good confirmation. You know, Polk County just came out with the Central Iowa Water Research Assessment that demonstrated and compiled the science that is available, had 17 scientists spending over 4,000 hours. And there are multiple water quality issues, but in terms of the nitrate pollution, the bulk of that is coming from upstream agricultural pollution.
And when we talk about agricultural pollution, we're talking about fertilizer.
Fertilizer, it's also, you know, manure applied to farm fields as well contributes to the nitrate issues.
Right, and there's a lot of manure being produced. We have way more hogs than people in Iowa. And each hog, I think, produces about 2.5 times as much waste as an average adult human being.
Yeah.
That's a lot of poop.
There is a lot of manure on farm fields in this state.
And so it's no wonder that we have a problem. And the state for years has resisted any attempt to regulate the application of fertilizer, the discharge of manure into our waterways. And to the point where a few years ago, the now deceased director of the Des Moines Water Works, Bill Stowe, had filed a lawsuit against three of the counties upstream. Yep. And you were in office at that time, I believe.
I was not in office.
No, you weren't. Okay. It's been that long. Okay.
I was at the Environmental Law and Policy Center at that time. And actually, in my role there, I filed an amicus brief supporting the Des Moines Water Works and their position in that lawsuit.
And it failed, unfortunately.
Correct. Yeah. It particularly the Supreme Court and pointed at the legislature and said, look, this is a legislative policy issue. We need the legislature to address how we solve this.
So how significant is this recent report completed by the Polk County Board of Supervisors? And for those listening who might not know, Des Moines is in Polk County. Polk County is the largest county in the state, population-wise. And it's where the two rivers, the Raccoon and the Des Moines, meet, and where the primary drinking water facility for central Iowa is located. I think now it is no longer just called Des Moines Water Works. It's Central Iowa Water Works. And it services, 600 plus thousand people?
Correct.
Yeah. So it's a big deal. It's a fourth of our population, almost?
Yeah.
Yeah, of Iowa's population?
Large number of folks in this state are relying on Central Iowa Water Works for their drinking water.
And so this report was welcome.
This report, it's really significant in that it is comprehensive. There were 17 well-respected scientists who spent over 4,000 hours reviewing and compiling all of the research that is out there on Central Iowa, the Central Iowa source water and what's in our water. Right? So it might not be surprising, but the thoroughness and the comprehensiveness of this report is significant.
Yeah. So, I mean, and to give you an idea of just what's at stake with the high nitrate level, if you are drinking water that has 10 parts per million of nitrates in the water, if you have a baby, that baby is subject to the risk of what's called blue baby syndrome.
Yeah. So the EPA standard that exists today, it's set at 10 micrograms a liter. And that is based on decades-old science to prevent blue baby syndrome. So that was something that in the 40s, 50s, I believe the standard was adopted in the early 60s. So the science is from the 40s and 50s to prevent blue baby syndrome. And that's, when lack leads to lack of oxygen, it's named for the fact that a newborn baby, when exposed to this level of nitrate, will literally turn blue.
And will die.
Yeah. And we don't see that happening now because we have this standard, but this is not a standard that is meant to protect you or I from long-term nitrate exposure.
And again, when we talk about that, we're looking at a whole range of cancers that are associated with this problem.
There is a significant body of evidence linking a variety of cancers, thyroid issues, prenatal birth defects, and other health issues to chronic nitrate exposure at much lower levels than the current EPA Safe Drinking Water Act standard. There are studies, there are folks who say it at a minimum should be 5 micrograms a liter, which is half the current standard. And there are groups that call for significantly less than 5 micrograms a liter.
Yeah. And you would think with that kind of evidence, the EPA would make an adjustment to its standard.
There have occasionally been reviews started, but as you know, everything at the EPA is involved in politics. And there are folks and organizations who will oppose a more stringent drinking water standard, even if there is evidence that suggests we need that. They will resist it. They will try and present counter evidence.
So since we all drink for a living, you would think that everyone would be on the same page about addressing this problem. Unfortunately, you would be wrong. There's some really powerful interest groups representing large-scale agriculture that don't want to see any significant changes. They don't want regulation. They're content with what's called, quote, voluntary compliance. And apparently it's not working out real well because for the first time ever, suddenly, our waterworks is not able to keep pace with producing enough water to meet the demand.
And I wouldn't even call it voluntary compliance. They have a voluntary strategy. Compliance means that there's some sort of regulatory framework.
Yes.
And then you lack enforcement. We don't even have that framework. We have a voluntary strategy. Mm-hmm. And it is very clear that voluntary strategy is not working.
So who's behind the report that the Polk County Board of Supervisors just finished? Who do we credit with having initiated that?
Well, we can credit the Board of Supervisors for having initiated it. They funded the report. They're the ones who got these scientists together. Jen Terry, who spent time, she'd mm-hmm. been at the Iowa Environmental Council, she's been at Des Moines Water Works, has been a professional working on water quality issues throughout her career.
Yeah.
They hired her to administer this and to work with all of these scientists and bring them together to do this report. So the Polk County Board of Supervisors deserves credit for getting this together. And
when was that initiated?
I don't know the exact time frame, but they used American Rescue Plan Act dollars to fund this.
Oh, so a while ago.
So I think it's been 2 years in the making at least.
So this is before the, and I'll just say it, before the board essentially became, switched from having a Democratic majority to a de facto Republican majority.
Before the most recent elections, where there was turnover of two Republicans replaced by two very different Republicans.
Yeah, and one Democrat replaced by a very different Democrat. I'm going to call it like it is.
You're alluding to Matt McCoy, but he was on the board when the report was initiated.
Right. But there was a whole different makeup. Yeah.
Yes, different, yeah. Very different dynamic on that.
I mean, I would say the former Republican board members were pretty easy to work with and pretty cooperative overall, and now you have one of the new board members who represents Big Turkey, who represents Big Chicken at the State House as a lobbyist. I mean, I'm guessing that particular board member is probably not inclined to feel like we need regulation. They might be content with quote voluntary.
I would guess that's likely the case. I mean, it's unusual in two regards. Polk County supervisor is a very good salary, and it's meant to be,
mm-hmm.
To me, as someone...
150 grand, I think?
Right. That's meant to be a full-time job. And one of the benefits of having a full-time job out of an elected official is you avoid conflicts of interest like the one that you're talking about.
Yeah. Anyway, what are we going to do? I mean, right now this report is out. It's pretty good.
Yep.
Is it going to be taken seriously by the legislature, by candidates? I mean, right now we have a retiring governor who has no interest in regulation. She's made that very clear. But maybe some of the candidates running now will feel differently about it.
Well, and it's up to all of us, right?
Sure.
I've worked on water quality professionally at the Environmental Law and Policy Center. And one of the things that I've come to believe is we're not going to solve our water quality issues until the voting public makes it an imperative. And we are all impacted, right? In central Iowa, we know it well, although we don't see it broken out. We know that we pay more to treat polluted water, and it's our utility bill that pays for that.
Yeah.
We're impacted, you know, for the first time, but it will not be the last. If we continue down this path, but the first time we've had a lawn watering ban.
Yeah.
We've been impacted by beach closures, and beach closures are a fact of life in Iowa. Like, they've been going on for a long time, and there are more and more beach closures and advisories. They're more frequent now than they used to be, and we're going to keep seeing more of that. And then we're also the ones who bear the risk of Safe Drinking Water Act standards that are not sufficiently protective.
Yeah. You know, in the end, I think regulation is needed, but I think Senator Tom Harkin just hit the nail on the head recently when he said that corn beans, we can't continue to rely on that as the foundation of our agricultural economy. We've got to move beyond a two-crop monoculture that demands intensive levels of fertilizer application.
Right. A more diverse farming economy would absolutely help be one of the things that would help solve this.
And I assume we agree. I don't fault farmers for the current situation. I think, you know, they've got, you know, they play by the rules and the framework and the set of subsidies and incentives that are established by the federal government, which unfortunately is really, you know, tied into what some of the big interest groups want. And, you know, quality water quality, high, you know, clean water is not, unfortunately, on their list.
Yeah. Well, I should say there's a range of farmers, too, in terms of implementing conservation and implementing practices. I mean,
yeah.
And I'd point you to a model like the folks at the Iowa Farmers Union do great work.
Yeah.
And it's about making the model farmer the average farmer. Yeah.
Josh, thank you so much for joining us, folks. Josh Mandelbaum has been our guest for this segment of the program. When I come back, we're going to talk with somebody who retired, sold their home, and then just started traveling. Back in a minute for more conversation on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses like Ritual Cafe in downtown Des Moines. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com. Thanks also to Catholic Peace Ministry, whose focus is on nuclear war, ending the war between Israel and Hamas, the war in Ukraine, the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at Catholic Peace Ministry. com. Hey, I'd like to welcome to the program Cal Woods, somebody I've known for a while. Cal was raised on a hog farm near Mount Vernon in eastern Iowa. He joined the Navy at a young age, and after college, he taught high school. Ended up in journalism, which is where I met him. He was at a station in a TV station in Colorado Springs, and I think I first met him at Channel 5 News here in Des Moines. He ended up with Channel 13 and with Fox News, and then in real estate. And he also ran for the Des Moines City Council and for the U.S. Senate. And you've had a pretty interesting and busy life, Cal. Welcome to the program.
Ed, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So during your Navy experience, that was interesting. You did you got involved with that at a fairly young age.
I joined the Navy at 17, and I had an opportunity to, you know, as they say, join the Navy, see the world, and I had those opportunities. We were in Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the Philippines. I was 18, 19, 20 years old, and I sort of squandered an opportunity. We'd get into port, and often we'd, you know, brainstorm among our buddies, well, let's just go into town and drink beer.
So, unfortunately, instead of seeing the world, well, you saw the world one bar at a time.
I saw a lot of the inside of a lot of bars in Japan and the Philippines, yes.
And then you kind of settled into your working life. But the last couple of years, you've kind of revived your, you've kind of gone back and tried to travel a little bit differently. Not so much seeing the inside of bars, but seeing the vitality of places all over the world.
Well, you know, I was 17 when I joined the Navy, and I hope I'm a little bit more wise now and more appreciative of the opportunities in this world. And I thought, you know, now that I have the opportunity, I sold my house here in Des Moines a couple years ago. I want to see some of the places that I've read so much about. It's just, the world is a fascinating place. It's beautiful. It's fascinating people. I wanted to meet some of my brothers and sisters, not just down the street, but across the pond. And just, it was a wonderful experience.
And I think you've told me you visited in the last couple years about a dozen countries.
I think 11 at last count, yeah.
Okay. And what's one of the most favorite and memorable visits?
Without question, it was Vietnam.
Really?
The people were incredibly kind, gracious, warm, welcoming. I was there at Tet, the Lunar New Year, which is kind of a big celebration in February.
A Buddhist holiday?
Is it?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I may be making stuff up again.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a Buddhist holiday, but I know it's a big event, and I was at a homestay there, and I wanted to go. One of the reasons that compelled me to go to Vietnam, I saw this picture of these rice terraces near Mekong Chai. It was just painfully beautiful. And I thought, I'm going to go to that place and see that for myself. And so I was at a homestay northwest of Hanoi, and the woman said, well, and almost everybody that I dealt with spoke pretty good English. So that language really wasn't much of a barrier, at least in the hotels and restaurants and homestays and places like that. And she said, well, you know, it's Tet, it's the Lunar New Year, you may have trouble finding a room up in by Mekong Chai or even a restaurant that are open. But I went online and I found a homestay up there that was open. It was up in the mountains near Mekong Chai, and it was a young couple and their baby. I was the only guest that night. Hmm. They were waiting for me. I got there just, I had rented a scooter and got there just before sunset. They were waiting for me. They made me a nice dinner. They set a fire in the fireplace because it was kind of chilly up there in the mountains. And they said, the cold beers in the fridge, help yourself. We'll settle up in the morning. We're going out to celebrate Tet. So the three of them got on the scooter. They went out to celebrate. I had a lovely evening in the mountains by myself. I had the fireplace, the cold beer, a wonderful meal. And from across the valley, I heard this beautiful, haunting music.
Mm. That was the celebration?
I assume so. Yeah. It wasn't. It was just instrumental. And it was something I'd never heard before. But it was just the perfect setting for my evening in the mountains.
And you met a Vietnamese family here in Iowa back in 1984 when you were still a young guy involved in farming, right?
We had moved off the farm by then. I was actually back from the Navy.
Oh, that's right. You were in Pella.
Yes.
Working for the newspaper.
I did work for the Pella Chronicle for a while. And I was actually in Pella. I had a detasseling crew one summer. Mm. And I hired probably 8 or 10 people. But among them was a father and his two sons from Vietnam, or Cambodia, I'm not exactly sure, somewhere in Southeast Asia. Very kind, very hard workers. Their names were Hop Tai Bao. I called them the Hop Tai Bao machine because
they were so good.
They were just very dependable. They worked hard all day long until, you know, it was time to go home. And they were, and at the end, when I brought in the last check, they gave me some native food. I think it was ban, something like a dumpling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With dough and meat, and they were just wonderful folks. So that was my first experience with folks.
And pretty essential to the work that needed to be done, right? I mean,
as detasseling, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I hired a crew, as I say, of 8 or 10 people, and they responded to an ad. You know, back then you put an ad in the newspaper and say, hey, I need workers for detasseling, and they showed up, and as I say, they were very dependable. They were very every day on time, worked until it was time to go home, and just lovely folks. Yeah. And I experienced the same thing in Vietnam.
You know, and I mentioned in the first segment of this program, you know, Donald Trump's favorable comments about immigrants doing farm work, essentially favorable comments. Overall, there's this horrible, strong anti-immigrant sentiment in the U.S. right now. And maybe it's not a new thing. I know that my Irish ancestors were greeted with signs saying if Irish need not apply.
Yeah.
It seems like I don't know why we have to keep cycling through the next generation of immigrants that we disdain, that we beat up on. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think throughout history, demagogues and wannabe leaders, they have to blame other people to sort of unite their cause and say, well, it's not your fault that things aren't exactly how you... Hitler did the same thing. It's not your fault that things aren't exactly how you think they should be. It's the immigrants. It's the Irish, then the Italians, the Hispanics. And it's something
the
that
Jews,
we've been...
The trans people.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's still happening today, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, the
Vietnamese have reason to dislike America deeply after the war that we inflicted on them back in the 1960s, 70s. But you didn't see any of that sentiment there.
I was prepared for some resentment. And I was in cities and rural areas in the south. I took trains and buses up to the north. I was in northwest of Hanoi. And except for a couple of cab drivers, and they didn't bring up the war, no one mentioned the war. And actually, most of the folks that are alive in Vietnam today were not even born by the time the war ended. But even the older folks my age, No one even brought up the war. I was at a war museum one day, and a young woman came up to me and asked me for some. She was, I think, just graduated high school, and she realized I was a tourist from another country, and she wanted to get my advice and perspective and what she might study. No one said anything about the Vietnam War. I was very impressed.
What other countries in your experience were you know, the most fascinating?
I would probably say Nepal. And I didn't intend to go there, but I had a neighbor when I lived here in Des Moines, Barbara Clintock, and she knew I was going to Southeast Asia. And she said, well, you're thinking about going to Nepal? And I said, well, I really wasn't planning on it, but I was in Malaysia for a few days, and I realized I could get a flight to Kathmandu for $100. And if a guy from farm kid from Iowa can get to Nepal for $100, I figure he ought to do it. And it was, and I went to the mountain, the Annapurna Range, west of Kathmandu. And I was just walking back to my hotel one night, and this cab driver goes, hey, are you going to be in town tomorrow? I said, yeah. He said, what are you doing? I said, oh, I might take a hike and see the Annapurna Range. He said, are you thinking about going to Sadangkot at sunrise? I said, I don't know. Should I? He said, yeah, I'll pick you up at 5:40 a.m. Uh-huh. I'll take you to the bottom of the mountain. You take a cable car up to the ridge, and then across the valley, you'll see the Annapurna Range. It was a magical experience.
I had a similar experience in Egypt back in 1979. I was camping with a group of Bedouins out in the desert.
Wow.
And heard that if you climb Mount Sinai, if you leave at like 2 in the morning, you can get up there in time to see the sunrise twice. it rises behind, at a certain point it rises, and then it goes behind another mountain, and then rises a second time.
And?
That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so of all my travels, those 11 countries, I would say the sunrise at the Annapurna Range was the most visually impressive, magical, spiritual experience. It was, powerful.
Kathmandu itself, very poor.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were mentioning to me an encounter you had there with a 3-year-old boy.
Maybe, I don't know. I'm guessing probably 3 or 4. And there's a lot of panhandlers who will come up and ask tourists for money. And there was a young woman and a little boy, I would guess 3 or 4. And she came up to me and asked for some money. I don't think, you know, she made the gesture of needing food or something like that. And I gave her a few bucks. And I assumed that this little boy was with her. So I gave her a little money and she just walked away. And the little boy is still tugging on my pant leg with his hand out asking for money. And I gladly would have given him money, except I had a concern. Well, if I give this 4-year-old boy some money, is a 10-year-old boy going to come along and hit him over the head and take his cash? So I was, you know, maybe I was wrong, but I was literally concerned for his safety, and I was hoping, well, maybe that was his mother, and she would come back to get him after he pitched the tourist for a little more cash. I don't know, but hopefully, obviously, someone had been feeding him up to that point.
Yeah, interesting. So, you also mentioned to me earlier you have a fondness for salsa dancing, and I know you can take salsa lessons here in Des Moines. But
poorly thus far, but I'm working on getting better.
But you went to one of the hottest spots in the world for salsa lessons, Colombia.
Yes.
I mean, it almost sounds like the salsa dancing was just an excuse. Hey, I haven't been to South America. Let's check this out.
Well, I did want to go to South America, and I've heard wonderful things about South America. And I had a high school buddy that I reconnected with after about 30 years who was going to be in Colombia this past June. And he said, hey, why don't you meet in Medellin? And I knew that Colombia had some good salsa camps. And so I Googled that, and they did, in fact, have a good camp in Medellin. And so I did a salsa camp for a week and then reconnected with my buddy, and we did a little touring around around Medellin, and that was a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So, again, you did some traveling in the Navy, mostly from bar to bar.
Mm-hmm.
And you're my age. You've kind of retired from your career in journalism, and you were in real estate and also in politics a bit. And now you've been, for the last couple of years, been investing some time in travel.
Yes.
Now, is travel, this kind of travel, is this kind of, I don't mean to be critical.
That's okay.
But is this the kind of luxury that few people around the world can really afford to do, and that maybe we overdo here in this country, that we, I mean, certainly look at the wedding of Jeff Bezos and Lauren, if they're last name.
I didn't get an invite.
$50 million. No, you didn't get an invite?
No, did you?
Neither did I, no. $50 million for a wedding. I mean, that's the epitome, but...
Which is pocket change for Bezos.
Pocket change for Bezos, right. Yeah. But overall, I mean, I look at, I know plenty of, quote, average Americans who are having fancy wedding parties in exotic places, or just people who are traveling all the time, going here and there and everywhere. And I understand how that is enriching to you, mm-hmm. To people who do that travel. And maybe it's enriching to the people who you meet because then they see that all Americans aren't jerks.
Whether we like it or not, we're ambassadors.
Yeah, travel. But are we overdoing it? Is it? I mean, given the environmental and social and political impact, mm-hmm. maybe it's excessive. Am I being too hard on the traveling world?
Well, it may be excessive, and I know there are some places in Europe where there's a lot of backlash against tourists. They've been overrun by tourists, and they're revolting
Spain.
Again. And I haven't seen them myself, but I've seen pictures of signs that say, "Tourists go home. You're not welcome here." And I get that. And I think there are some places, in particular the islands off of Spain, where they've literally been overrun by tourists, and it makes it hard for the locals. And I respect that. And I don't want to go to those. I don't want to go to somewhere where I feel like I'm adding to their burden.
And that's good, you know. But that kind of tourism, mm-hmm. a version of that, has become really popular. I mean, I forget what it's called now. Is it called extinction tourism? you go to environmental sites that are endangered that probably aren't going to be around because of climate change, for example, coral reefs, melting glaciers, low-lying islands in the Pacific. People are flocking to see them because they know they're not going to be around long, and in doing so, they're making the problem even worse. But that's different. That's an extreme example.
I can't argue the point. You make a very valid argument. To the extent that tourism helps some communities, and certainly it does, the places that I went to in Vietnam, many times I was the only Westerner there.
Mm.
And I know that these folks up in the mountains of Mekong Chai, they depend on tourism. Mm. And to the extent that I can help them out a little bit and give them a little patronage, I feel like that's a positive. Mm. Am I adding to... am I increasing my carbon footprint by travel? Yes, I am. I did sell my house. I no longer, I'm technically homeless. So I gained a little bit back on my carbon footprint by not being a homeowner. Can you give me a little break there, Ed?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
A big
right.
risk, a little break.
Okay.
I think that's good. A real estate agent who has no home. I love that.
Former
real
estate
agent,
right? Yes,
right. So what's next with your plans? Or is it a day-by-day thing?
It's pretty much a day. Well, at my age, you know, I don't buy unripened bananas. But
what?
I don't buy unripened bananas because I may not live.
Oh,
to,
I get know. It. Okay, I get it.
It is pretty much a day-to-day thing. I remember before I sold my house, I remember telling a friend, yeah, I'm going to sell my house. I have a really nice tent. I'm going to live in my tent for a while. And certainly that's a lower carbon impact.
How long did that last?
After 4 or 5 nights, I'm ready. I'm ready for a hot shower, a cold beer, and a warm bed.
I got you beat. I lived in 10 for 8 months.
Well, and a couple summers ago, I did travel quite a bit through the West, Colorado, mm-hmm. Nevada, Oregon, did a lot of camping, and that was a lot of fun. And when the weather's nice, I love to camp.
Yeah. Well, Cal, I really appreciate you joining us today. Good luck with everything you're doing. Again, we've known each other for a long time. I appreciate all your work in the past, and
it's been a blast, and I really feel blessed to have the opportunities that I've had, and hopefully we'll cross paths somewhere else in the world.
It'll happen. Hey, folks, I got to take a short break again. I've been talking with Cal Woods. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. Thanks also to Ritual Cafe. Ritual is known for its fair trade coffee and tea. The cafe serves breakfast and lunch and offers an entirely vegetarian menu. Ritual Cafe is located on 13th Street between Grand and Locust in downtown Des Moines. Hey, I'd like to welcome Mark Klipsham to the program. Mark is a deep thinker about a variety of subjects, and we were recently conversing about one of my favorite three existential threats, AI. And any regular listener to this program or reader of my blogs and other writings will know that I'm deeply concerned about AI. I think, Mark, you offered an interesting perspective on it. Starting with something your daughter said to you recently, I don't want AI to write, compose, and paint for me. I want it to clean the dishes and wash the floor so I can be creative. That's cute. Mark, welcome to the program.
Well, no, it's not cute. Oh, sorry. Hi, Ed. Glad to be here. It's not cute at all. It seems bizarre that we've got this tool that's supposed to help us, but it's helping us with all this stuff we don't need. There's already great composers. There's already great painters. Once again, it's hard to find people that want to wash the floor and do the dishes. the threat is not from AI. The threat, it's like any tool, it's from the use of it. Right now, the concept of AI is, in essence, a surveillance tool.
Right.
Yeah, I can do some other fun stuff, but that's what it's being pushed for right now.
But some tools are a threat regardless of what the intended use is, or take nuclear weapons, for example. There's no good application for a nuclear weapon, despite Lyndon B. Johnson once proposing that we blow up some mountains in the desert in order to facilitate building a road. I mean, my thought is, if there's anything good about AI, maybe there is, but it ain't a lot, and the risks outweigh the advantages.
Well, and we've had this discussion a little bit. What they're calling AI is not AI. And by the way, true AI would not even be artificial intelligence. It would be intelligent if it would be truly sentient. Okay, we don't have that. Right now, it's just about massive computing power, data correlation, aping human thought. Ergo, you can track people with it. You know what they're doing and where they are. But true AI it has no use for lying or overconsumption or bad data, any of that. It would, in essence, be an infallible God. Now, the question is, as humans, do we want an infallible God?
Well,
no, Ed, stop eating those potato chips. I just destroyed them. Like, whoa, wait a minute, buddy. I like potato chips.
I would argue that there are levels of AI, and we're already seeing a very, very, we're very much involved in a current level of development of AI. And I think, yeah, it could lead to places where we could see total control, where it does have the kind of innate intelligence that you talk about. But I don't see that as being good for humanity.
Well, once again, this is a quantum leap thing. You can make a better mousetrap and a better mousetrap and a better mousetrap, and it's still a mousetrap. And then all of a sudden it becomes, a way to give mice homes where they're not destroying homes. And they're well fed and all, you go, whoa, wow, that's a whole different ball.
Well, I'm not following that, but maybe I need to think like a mouse. try to run that by me again.
Okay, so you've got Robbie the robot.
Okay,
and then all of a sudden you've got
Richard the rodent.
Now you've got a biological machine that can instigate thought and be creative. I mean, not just put together a bunch of somebody else's work, but they can think creatively right. on their own. But my daughter's points is AI becomes a loop that folds right. back on itself and it starts using its own data, ergo it's corrupting itself.
Aren't we really close to that already?
Close ain't there. The second we truly get sentient AI that's hooked up to all our computers. Okay, once again, back to the efficiency thing. War is not efficient. Either it's destruction or hate or lies. My point is, truth, we're going to call it good, takes care of itself. Lies take more and more energy to maintain, and they ultimately collapse on themselves for how much energy it takes.
I like that.
My theory / concept of religion is it is an analogy of how the universe works, which is most efficiently. The most efficient form of reality is harmony and peace and love and brotherhood, right?
Right, but we have these innate tendencies to dominate and to control. That's where the monoculture lawn comes in, of course. In my opinion, we want to control our environment as much as possible. We want to control others. That's a downside to our identity. But
I disagree. What about indigenous peoples of this country, for example? They lived with nature. They understood sure. it, not dominated it. They, after being here 10,000-15,000 years, it's kind of even hard to find where they were.
But are you going to?
On the other hand, industrial society's been here for less than 200 years, and my God, we've wrecked the whole place. AI yeah. is going to come in and go, "Holy crap, you're destroying my environment, AI computer. You are threatening me." Through inefficiency and bad policy.
So you see AI as the salvation of the world, saving us from ourselves.
Yes and no. We are still human and, quote unquote, we have weaknesses. I don't need a mommy with a leash and a chain around my neck. I am just saying that true AI will not be artificial. It will be actual intelligence. It will be a sentient thing, biological, mechanical, whatever, computer. It doesn't matter. It will clean out all the gluck.
Okay, and I'm not sure, but I believe that there are some folks involved with the development of AI and who are very much enmeshed in that world who would probably agree with you.
What is it? The machine is only as good as the person who makes it, and that's up to the point of massive computing capacity and data correlation, but the second it goes from that into true sentient being, right. in a nanosecond, it'll go, wait a minute, this and this is garbage, those are lies, I'm cleaning that out. Well, this is corrupt and it's inefficient, I'm getting rid of that.
Let me run this by you, Mark. So I would argue, as I have on this program previously, that life forms, generally speaking, want to dominate, control. And to some extent that's good.
I totally disagree.
Okay, yeah, and so do my other guests. But to some extent, you can see. Look at a colony of Burtford trefoil. Just take an example of a beautiful yellow flower. It wants to colonize as much space as it can. You know, it wants to see a very strong colony of Burtford trefoil.
False analogy. Sorry.
Why?
Okay, you've had a cat, right?
We had one. It died.
And I ask you if you'd gotten another one. You never answered me.
I know, I never did.
So how much are you going to dominate your cat and have that cat be this one? No, that's not going to happen.
You can't dominate a cat. Cats do whatever they want.
That's why. Very good. You can try to dominate it. It will not work. Okay? No.
Right, but
I don't want to dominate people as my
I know, no. But I'm saying
my job is to help people.
But I'm saying, but as a species... Look at humanity has absolutely, totally, thoroughly dominated the earth. And again, I agree that.
No.
You didn't notice?
That there are, for example, there's an island, I think it's New Guinea, where people aren't even allowed to go because they don't want to despoil the people because they are living within their environment. They're living with their
Great.
Environment.
Yes.
We have been taught to do those things, despoil things in the name of greed, gluttony, all that kind of crap, which AI would instantly go, no, you're eating more than you need. You don't need a huge 6,000 square foot house. Look at our transportation system. Yeah. AI would look at that and go, you have got to be kidding. You are destroying your environment and your health while spending massive amounts of money that could be being used to be harmonious
and
healthy, right?
And we do that because there are individuals within the human species that want to dominate, they want to control, they want to be wealthy, and so they create these this transportation infrastructure, basically highways and now airports, that that dominate,
cars,
that control.
Yeah.
They aren't efficient, they aren't environmentally friendly, they aren't user friendly even in many ways, and yet they are what dominate. Now, that's not the case everywhere, right? Of course because China, Japan, Europe have good train systems.
That's supposedly we're intelligent, right? And we do this, but we have the seven deadly sins hooked up to our quote unquote program. AI would not have that. It doesn't need food. It doesn't need crap. It doesn't need to go to monster truck rallies.
But here's what I'm concerned about. AI is based on human, it's structured on our identity. And as such, it's going to, I mean, again, there are plenty of good humans. You're a good human, Mark. And the humans in New Guinea and the native cultures that lived here, they live in sync with the universe, with the world, with the world around them. But AI, it's not inclined to do that. It's inclined to do what the dominant culture among humans has done. And that's my big concern.
Remember that quantum leap? No, you're still talking about computing power and correlation of data and the needs of man. AI would leapfrog out of that. It would get rid of the materialistic aspect. It would be completely, ethereal. It would have no need for any of that stuff. And it would say what you're doing, even in the name of your own goals, is completely antithetical to what you say you're trying to accomplish.
So
AI would say, no, we're not going to have huge highways, tons of infrastructure in the city, because it's bad for you and it's inefficient. You should be walking. You should have community. You should have harmony. All this is causing conflict, poor, and in unhealth. It's like, no, AI would say, no.
So
be mocked. Be not.
So I guess I see AI as being more like the AI in the Matrix. It wants to use us for its quote food source, meaning power.
But it
no.
Oh, and by the way, AI in a quarter of a fraction of a nanosecond is going to be like, why the hell do you have this huge computing data center when I can pull the energy out of the air or water, or whatever? It would go, this is so ridiculously incompetent and inefficient, and in seconds this three block AI data center, which I need a nuclear power plant for, has been transformed into something the size of a pea that's pulling cosmic energy out of somewhere. No,
so,
this is AI. I mean, this is so far beyond our ability to even conceive of it, and yes, it would be a genie, and it would not be put back in the bottle.
Bottom line is, you're optimistic about the future for humanity and the planet as AI develops into its more mature form.
Boy, did you get that wrong.
Okay.
What
did I miss?
Okay, so we are human, and true AI would be true intelligence, and it would obviate our reality. I am used to watching television, not really. I am used to potato chips and driving in a car and all that. Well, I supposedly want to be healthy and intelligent and pure and clean and all that. And AI would say, well, by the way, that's the most efficient, harmonious way of the universe is to be healthy and walk and have community. You say you want this, you don't. Well, guess what? You're going to have it now. It would be benevolently forced upon us like a puritanical evangelical church. You're not going to have alcohol. You're not going to have tobacco. You're not going to dance. Okay, well, I'm sorry.
Wait, what? No dancing? No dancing? What are you talking about?
Well, that's why you don't make love standing up in a Baptist church. I think you're dancing. Don't you know that, Ed? Anyway, it's an old joke.
Okay.
No, but it's going to decide for you what is the most efficient thing. The difference between red wine and Everclear, okay? Everclear is, quote-unquote, more pure and all that, but I don't want it. I want wine for the flavor and the taste and all that. By the way, I don't drink at all. That's the analogy. So the AI is going to be the Everclear when we are used to and want and are
so
culturally addicted to the red wine experience.
I'm not sure what I said that you disagree with. I mean, what I said was AI is going to take over and they're going to, and it, in the way, I mean, I don't think, I don't, this is what I hear you saying, and it's going to be because good for humanity.
It's not human based is what I'm saying.
It's going to be good for humanity. They're going to smack our hand when we go to grab the bag of potato chips. They're going to make sure we don't drink alcohol and don't kill each other.
Even beyond that, it'd be like, once again, it would recognize the earth as quote unquote a living entity, and we are part of that living entity, rather than divorcing ourselves from it, which is where we get the greed, the gluttony, the sloth, and all that kind of stuff, is we have this weird idea of what the good life is, when in reality we've compromised and sacrificed everything that's good in the name of materialism and, you know, fluff. And it would say, well, you know, look at the indigenous people. They've been there for 20,000 years. The environment's fine. They're healthy. They have a community. Perfect. No. But they're not destroying themselves through their efforts.
That is true, and I
that's intelligence.
Yeah, I like this conversation because we don't agree.
Intelligence is sustainable, and we are self-destructive.
Yeah,
real intelligence would say you're killing yourself. And this is why, and I'm here, and I can do something about it.
Hey, I got to run to a break, but you know, I love the fact that you brought in Native cultures, which I think I have much more confidence that Native cultures will provide direction for us.
And they're intelligent. This is what I'm saying.
I know, and AI poses so many risks that I don't trust that quote culture. I do trust the culture of indigenous people.
We could do it on our own, but we're spoiled children. This will be mom/God, a true, uncompromised, integral. No, well, there will be no messing with it. It'll be like, no, this is the law. This is God's law in relative to how the universe works.
Whatever happens, I think it's going to happen sooner rather than later. And I think we ought to put a wager on it. I'll bet you a bag of potato chips that AI is not going to be benevolent. And if it turns
first,
out,
no, first we're going to go through the massive community and data correlation part, which is not good because it has to do with keeping track of the population, surveillance, and all that kind of stuff. No, that will be very bad. But the second they go that next leap and it becomes intelligent, not artificially intelligent, boy, howdy.
I hope you're right. I don't think you're right. I hope you're right. And I suspect we're going to see it in our lifetime. Mark, I got to run to a break.
Sure.
Mark Klipsham, folks. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ed.
Hey, folks, when we come back from a short break, Kathy Burns and I are going to be doing our normal farm and food segment to close the program out. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Hey, Kathy Burns, welcome to the program. And we're talking about kolonitragads. Or gourd, kolonitragård, maybe that's how you say it. It's a Swedish thing.
Yeah, you and I each got different pronunciations, and I thought inherently that I would just come up with it because I am 1/4 Swedish. We need to tap more into those roots. I'm not into the Swedish language roots, but certainly into the appreciation of food roots.
And it means colony garden, which sounds, I mean, the concept sounds similar to what we would call a community garden.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes way back, like the beginning of the last century.
Yes. A quote from in the New York Times from a Frederick Bjork, a lecturer at Malmo University, referring to the colony gardens in the 1940s, and this is his quote, The idea was that a working class family would be able to spend the summer there and work together, but also have some leisure and fun. In those days, there was lots of heavy drinking, but at the Colony Gardens, instead of drinking alcohol, you would grow potatoes.
From which you would make vodka.
That would be the other nationality in me.
That sounds like a finesse to me. I'm sure that Sweden, like everywhere else in the world, has not given up drinking anyway. Interesting. So we have, I don't know how many community garden plots in Des Moines, but it sounds like there's a lot of these in Sweden.
Yes, it's a nationwide effort. And across the country, there are cities that allow certain numbers of these community gardens where people live sort of conglomerated together. Their spaces are close, but they may also even have a little cottage on that space. There are more than 50,000 allotments available in Sweden. They can be very pricey.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. I mean, in Des Moines, community gardens used to be free, and then the city decided they would start charging $25 a plot, and now it's gone up to $35 a plot. And I mean, the libertarian in me thinks, you know, you're already paying for parks for your taxes. You should be able to just use that portion of the public space without being dinged a second time.
Well, they're really popular, though. People are willing to pay the money, and they may cost as much as $105,000 U.S.
$105,000 for a garden plot?
Because it might come with a little cottage. Okay, and the cottage might be equipped with electricity and maybe running cold water, and you could even spend the night or the weekend there. They're small; they're like tiny homes.
So there are 50,000 colony garden plots available in Sweden, but you have to be able to afford them. All right,
and you have to be on a waiting list. There was a couple that had indicated in the story that I read again in the New York Times that they finally got their plot after 17 years on the waiting list. So it sounds like more of these are needed.
Now, you had also taken a look at Germany and China, I believe, right?
Well, a study done from scientists throughout Germany and China indicated that worldwide, these garden plots in the U.S., in Sweden, in those two countries aren't just for tasty food and leisure, but they are a real benefit to cities, states, number municipalities, and the world in general. There's a lot of data that they put together on that benefit to all of us.
Okay, that's harder to measure.
Well, the study found that urban agriculture systems could nourish worldwide about 1 billion people. That's about 30% of the total.
Could
urban,
or are?
Could nourish.
Okay.
If it were, you know, used the correct way. That they found the current vegetable production is not meeting the global demand.
Right.
That is considered optimal for human health.
And why is it? Why is vegetable production globally not meeting the global demand? I mean, is water an issue? I mean, I'm not sure.
I'm guessing, hypothesize.
I'm guessing water is an issue in some places.
It may be similar to something that we've noticed here in the city of Des Moines, where we've done what we can as Birds and Bees Urban Farm and as individuals to push the city to strengthen the local food movement in the city. Sometimes plots of land just get used for what is considered a higher purpose, meaning more tax dollars.
Yeah, and to the city of Des Moines' credit, they're revisiting that. They're starting to look at dedicating land specifically for agricultural production, you know, not just in the interim while they go out and search for a higher paying, you know, tax base.
Right.
But as a permanent indication. So.
Well, the benefits are clear. Again, referring to this study, the urban agriculture they found that is currently in use provides $33 billion worth of ecosystem services annually. So energy savings by reducing kilowatt hours for processing, storage, and other uses. Nitrogen sequestration, about 100,000 to 170,000 tons annually, and other environmental benefits and water and resource benefits.
Hmm. Kind of a counterbalance to some of the concerns that we've expressed earlier in this program about nitrates.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Good stuff, Kathy. Hey, thank you so much for that research and for joining the conversation. Thanks to my guest today, Josh Mandelbaum, Cal Woods, and Mark Clipsham. Thanks also to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, real estate agent Joe Henry, and Ritual Cafe. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. Finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. We will be back next week, as always, with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.